Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the dangerously dysfunctional White House that prompted a high-ranking serving senior officer, General Tony Thomas, the head of JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, to warn that, quote, our government continues to be in unbelievable turmoil. I hope they sort it out because we are a nation at war. A veteran observer of Washington politics, Norman Ornstein, a contributing writer and editor for The Atlantic and co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Was, joins us to discuss how the White House's chaotic first month undercuts Trump's appeal to the electorate that he is a successful businessman who will get things done. But in spite of it, the Republican leadership, who are busy enacting an aggressive agenda as they implement their right-wing wish list, appear to be quite happy with the situation and don't see the need for any investigations. Then we'll speak with Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, Lying Got Michael Flynn Fired, But That's What the Trump White House Does Best, and the extent to which lying has become institutionalized in the Trump administration, whose use of fake news plays well with their core constituency inside the Fox News bubble. The roughly 30% of Americans Trump talks directly to via Twitter in an alternative universe to the readers of what Trump calls the failing New York Times. Then finally, we'll examine the downfall of Trump's nominee for Secretary of Labor, Andy Puzder, who withdrew his nomination amid mounting concerns about his record of alleged domestic violence and spousal abuse. Judith Conte, the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the National Employment Law Project, joins us to discuss the other factors that cast doubt on the nominee, such as his repeated failure to provide documents leading to 5 separate delays of his confirmation and the opposition to his hostility to labor by the Fight for 15 movement. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing writer and editor for The Atlantic, and he is also a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research and an Election Eve analyst for BBC News. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
So now it's even worse than it was. What new adjectives can you come up with?
Well, we've often joked that perhaps the next one will be run for your lives. But we've never seen anything like this, certainly in our lifetimes. The kind of chaos and dissent, the madness, was less than a month into a presidency. He had talked about American carnage. And, President Trump was talking about Chicago and murders, while also basically saying that the murder rate in the country has gone up dramatically when it's gone down, which is another part of our dynamic and problem here. But we could use it to refer to our constitutional system at the moment.
Well, I find particularly extraordinary about the response from Donald Trump to the Flynn situation, and of course we don't know the full story, and so, I've been told by some former senior NSC senior staffers that maybe there's even a greater smoking gun, that there's suspicion that the phone calls to the Russian ambassador from General Michael Flynn before he became the National Security Advisor, when he was still a public citizen, might have involved tipping the Russians off about who was going to have their money frozen by Treasury. So there's a lot more to learn, obviously, and there's a political battle going on between the Republicans and the Democrats over having any kind of real inquiry. But the president's himself's response so far has been completely bizarre, and he's doubling down, attacking the intelligence community. One of his latest tweets is, information is being illegally given to the failing New York Times and Washington Post by the intelligence community, NSA and FBI, just like Russia. The real scandal here is that classified information is illegally given out by intelligence like candy. Very un-American. Now, that's not going to, if you want to, you know, kick a hornet's nest, go ahead. But the intelligence community is not a hornet's nest that you want to kick.
And that's become pretty clear as we've seen these leaks emerge. But the leaks that are emerging are very, very troubling ones. And just as troubling is that we have now seen in a succession of tweets a president who blames the, as he says, the failing New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and the intelligence services, and he's focused on the leaks. And there's one actor or set of actors that is conspicuously absent in terms of who gets blamed: Russia. So this is beyond bizarre. And what now appears to be the case is that there were multiple, even massive communications with Trump's people, staffers, those close to him, with the Russians, including Russian intelligence services, during the course of the campaign. I can think of, frankly, no benign explanation for any of this. And if you look at one incident that was particularly troubling and bizarre, which is language in the Republican platform changed mysteriously to take out tough references to Russia when it came to its territorial incursions, you can begin to think of a lot of very, very difficult implications for all of this, and implications that cry out for an independent prosecutor. Not the sort of thing I really want to see done in a Senate Intelligence Committee where almost all of its activities are behind closed doors and private, and certainly not by the Justice Department, where there is a flat-out regulation that would disqualify Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, requiring him to recuse himself because of his own conflicts, having served in a formal position in the National Security Advisory Committee in the Trump campaign. And the fact that he is at this point resisting recusing himself makes this even more troubling.
But in the broader sense, though, surely given the news that we've just had and the breaking story from the New York Times about the Trump campaign's connections and communications with senior Russian intelligence officials, and there again, it's only the tip of the iceberg. This is an ongoing investigation. Clearly, the problem is not with the U.S. intelligence community, which is the way the president is trying to frame it. It's with the president's collusion with Russian intelligence.
Exactly so, and directly with Putin. And, you know, there are more twists to this, Ian, that we haven't even begun to get to. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, was at that table with Vladimir Putin and Michael Flynn at the RT, we know, the Russian Propaganda Network, gala in Moscow before the election, and RT sponsored the Green Party debate. Now, whether Jill Stein was a sort of unwitting tool of the Russians, who are trying to not only sow discord, but defeat Hillary Clinton by any means necessary, including, you know, peeling off some share of the left, or there's something more troubling about that, we don't know. There are a lot of questions here, and we now see, by the way, the Russians doing similar kinds of things in France, trying to tip the election to Marine Le Pen, in Germany to try and sow discord and undermine Angela Merkel. And with all of this and an investigation that will unwind and take a period of time, Donald Trump remains president, and he could move forward and change policy towards Russia on sanctions, giving them much more ability to go into the Baltics. And of course, we also know the other twist in this, which is that the Russians have gone against the treaties, violated the agreements, and created a battalion of cruise missiles that could be devastating in Europe, and basically daring Donald Trump to take any kind of retaliatory action or do anything about it. We're in such uncharted territory, chaos in the White House, a group of people who are the closest advisors to the president, who lie repeatedly when they go on television or do press conferences, a president who can't keep from lying, it's a nightmare of immense proportions.
And again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing writer and editor for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He is an election eve analyst for BBC News and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, which is co-authored with Thomas Mann, and it's now out in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. Now, I actually had a conversation right here in the same studio I'm speaking from, Norm, with Jill Stein about Russia, and she got distinctly uncomfortable. But what's important about what you just said in terms of whether or not she could have been what the KGB used to refer to as a useful idiot, along with WikiLeaks and others, in helping the Russian program to make sure that Trump beat Hillary Clinton, which was an uphill climb. But nevertheless, the statistics are pretty clear. Jill Stein got more votes in those key three states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania than Hillary Clinton lost by the 77,000 vote margin that she lost by. So I know that's the case that was often brought up about Ralph Nader's in Florida in 2000, but it's nevertheless, you know, you can't make the case that every green person, had she not been running, would have voted for Hillary. But nevertheless, the math does speak for itself.
And you really begin to wonder about funding for the party beyond the debate itself. It makes you wonder about a lot of other dynamics here during the campaign. If we uncover evidence, and the investigation does, that there was direct collusion between people very close to Donald Trump and Russia to try and change the outcome of our election, we're talking about something that could make everybody's head explode. We're talking about an unprecedented collusion with an enemy of the United States. And we don't have any real feature in the Constitution to do what, under those circumstances, should be done, which is a do-over. And, of course, if we go down the line, we don't know whether Mike Pence was completely out of the loop on any of this. There's no reason to imagine that he was a part of all of this. But you move from Trump to Pence to Paul Ryan to Orrin Hatch when it comes to the presidency. It's very clear that very bad things happened during the course of this campaign, and we now have a president who has no idea about how to operate as a president.
Well, you mentioned the lying, and it's institutionalized in this White House, and I don't think we've ever seen anything like this. When they talk about fake news, the other word for fake news is propaganda. And propaganda is the norm. It was the norm in the Soviet Union. It's become the norm in Russia. It's certainly the norm in China. Recently, the new Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, exhorted all of the top media people in China and pointed out to them that their job was not journalism, but propaganda, and reminded them that that was their priority. Now, we've never had propaganda institutionalized in this country, but already we know, at least from polls, that the fake news and the lying that comes from Kellyanne Conway and the White House works with the, 30%+ of Americans who supported Trump and still believe in him. So that's the real, my sense, where the rubber meets the road. And how can these people continue to support this man whose major calling card to be elected was, I'm a businessman and I'll get things done? And clearly, he is an incredibly incompetent manager.
So we have, of course, the president himself repeatedly lying about 3 to 5 million illegal votes cast, saying in a gathering of senators that there were thousands of illegals bussed into New Hampshire from Massachusetts, which is completely false, and we're getting false reports, and he just keeps repeating these things. And that's a pretext, obviously, for trying to move in and do some very severe voter suppression. We have Kellyanne Conway talking about alternative facts. And we have a news media that has its own set of challenges. And we're seeing some outlets step up to the plate. The Washington Post and the New York Times have done some exemplary work on all of this as we see events unfold. But I must say, when you look at these stories about Russia now and the Times breaking many of them about the multiple contacts between the Trump forces and Russian intelligence operations, it reminded me that a week before the election, the Times had a front page above the fold story. FBI does not see any linkage between Trump campaign and Russia. And that, a week before the election, when the other news was the Comey letter, said one thing's really important, the other thing, nothing going on there. And that makes me wonder about James Comey and the FBI. And I think beyond an independent investigation of the Russian contacts here directly, we need an investigation of the FBI done independently, including of the director.
Well, we know that Comey did lie to the New York Times. Now, you can argue, well, he's entitled to keep secrets. But the questions were about whether this FISA warrant had been issued in October, which we now learn had been issued, and we now learn who the targets were, Manafort, Carter Page, and Roger Stone. And there was even some talk earlier, and it's still not verified, that there was a fourth name on that FISA warrant, Donald Trump.
So we know as well now that Sally Yates, when she was acting Attorney General, very alarmed at the possibility that Michael Flynn could be blackmailed by Russia, wanted to notify the White House as soon as that information became solidified. And Comey resisted that until there was it was going to be leaked and reported. And there are just questions here that I do not find easy to answer without getting very dark.
Well, on the surface, it would seem that if you accept Hillary Clinton's charge that Comey's letter was decisive and she blames him for her loss, and obviously there's a lot of other reasons why she lost, but nevertheless, if that is the case, then I guess he's protecting his choice, right? if he decided to tip the scales in Trump's favor, you know, is it a question of when does he get buyer's remorse?
We just don't know. Among other things, it seemed fairly clear during the course of the campaign that the New York FBI, in collusion with Rudy Giuliani, had this computer from Anthony Weiner more than a month before the election, knew that there were emails on it from his wife, and held on to that information and did not notify Comey or Washington until 10 days before the election. This is really just rotten stuff. And it is, if we're going to have a political system that retains any of the elements of a republic, small r, and our democracy, we have got to get to the bottom of all of this.
Well, when I was mentioning earlier, Norman Ornstein, about the questions of that Donald Trump's main resume in running for president was, I'm not a politician, I'm a businessman, I can get things done. He's not getting things done, and he doesn't appear to be a good manager. And you know, the excuse might well be that he's had a private family company where he's only had a small circle of trusted family members, and that's how he's run things, and he's trying to replicate that in the White House, and it's clearly not working. But in terms of competence, though, when you have General Tony Thomas, the head of JSOC down at CENTCOM, the Joint Special Operations Command, going public, which serving officers never do, saying our government continues to be in unbelievable turmoil. I hope they sort it out soon because we're a nation at war. Now, that is pretty amazing for a serving officer to step out of line and say something like that.
To say the least, it should make everybody very, very nervous. And, of course, this farce of the president who doubled the fees at Mar-a-Lago after he became president, kleptocracy redux, making sure that he could directly profit from his office, and then going down there with Japanese Prime Minister Abe and sitting in the middle of a crowded ballroom surrounded by waiters and others, and God knows who might have been eager to get classified information, and conducting the kind of session that should normally be done in the Situation Room or in an utterly secure facility after news came of the North Korean missile launch, may have had something to do with prompting a top official still in the government to issue this kind of warning.
Well, just in closing, Norman Ornstein, does this help or hurt the Republican Party? I mean, Donald Trump delivered up the power to them, and that's what Ryan said on the day after the election. You know, he thanked Trump for having basically put them all in the majority, both in the House and the Senate. And I'm just wondering whether this serves as a kind of smokescreen of chaos, a smokescreen of chaos, while behind which the House, Republican House and Senate are moving ahead with their own agenda. So, or is this going to come back to bite them in 2018?
So there are a few points to make here, Ian. The first is we had a comment made just, I think, this morning by Mitch McConnell on Morning Joe, where he was almost gushing about Trump, who is giving them the opportunity to cut taxes, blow up regulations, and pick a great Supreme Court justice and probably more judges. And, you know, what I took from that is, hey, you know, this guy may be a disaster and he may be a narcissistic sociopath, but we're getting what we want. And that does not bode well for, among other things, investigations into the Russian connection. At the same time, we have to keep in mind that some of the more recent surveys that show Trump's approval rating around 40 to 42%, when you parse it out, his support among Republicans in Republican congressional districts is almost 90%. The opposition is coming from Democrats and independents, but for most Republicans in Congress, they're looking at their primary voters, their core of voters, who are still with Donald Trump. They're not hearing about this stuff. You know, Fox and Friends, when it reports anything about these things, takes Trump's viewpoint, which is that this is a conspiracy of the CIA and the Washington Post and New York Times. And it's being very unfair to the president. That's what they're getting from talk radio or from Sean Hannity. So until we see this reverberate down to some of those Republican core voters, and it may well, as we see possibly a trade war, or as we see fallout from whatever they do or don't do with the Affordable Care Act, for a lot of those voters who may then say, gee, this is not what he promised us, maybe we'll see some changes, and then you're going to see a different approach by Republicans. We are seeing it a little bit with people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain. But when you look at the chair of the Intelligence Committee in the House, Devin Nunes, who is basically trying to whitewash all of this, Paul Ryan, who said nothing critical, McConnell, as I've mentioned, the vast majority of them staying silent, it's not encouraging.
Well, Norman Ornstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, of course. Absolutely, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein. He's a contributing writer and editor for The Atlantic and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's an election eve analyst for BBC News and the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, and now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the extent to which lying has become institutionalized in the Trump administration. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Duke Manich and the Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, Lying Got Michael Flynn Fired, but That's What the Trump White House Does Best. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
Pleasure to be here.
And it is an extraordinary situation now where Donald Trump is striking back not at the Russians, but he's striking back at the U.S. intelligence service. It's just, you know, a case of shooting the messenger, and that doesn't seem like the smartest target. You know, there are some reports that the intelligence community is ready to go nuclear. But in general, what concerns me mostly about the institutionalization of lying in the White House is that it could lead to a condition of state propaganda. You already have, in effect, Fox News as the Pravda of the Republican Party. But if that metastasizes into the rest of the press and we accept propaganda instead of news, and we already live in a country where there's no consensus about what is true anymore.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, one of the things that I think is kind of a signature of Trump is not only does he tell what we can describe as kind of these garden variety lies where he makes things up, you know, as noxious as they are, where he, you know, says that, you know, but for the fact of all these millions of unregistered voters, I would have won the popular vote. So he engages in these kind of what I would describe more of these dramatic but nonetheless garden variety lies. But then he also engages in what I would describe as meta-lies. That is, he lies about the very institutions in a democracy that are meant to protect the truth. And I think three institutions really stand out. It's the university, it's the courts, and it's the media. And it's interesting that Trump attacks all three. He attacks all three relentlessly. And in particular, he's been a little less vocal in his attacks on the university, though he did say scandalous things about the University of California, Berkeley, after there was a small riot in the town of Berkeley, unrelated to anything at the university. But he's been relentless in his attacks on the media and on the courts. And these, again, these are the institutions that really are designed in a democracy to help citizens judge the truth of statements that are coming from politicians. And if you erode confidence in those institutions, then you really have created a world in which up is down and black is white.
Well, it's pretty straightforward and cynical, isn't it, in terms of Stephen Bannon, the chief strategist, and his worldview, since he embraces the notion of propaganda and believes that somehow we in the West have fallen asleep and we don't recognize the real dangers out there, and it's like the sort of Strauss idea of the noble lie. Is that what's happening here? Because the only people that can hold this administration to account, really, are the press. So, and Bannon's already said that the real opposition is the press, not the Democratic Party.
Yes, again, which is a shocking thing to say. I mean, Bannon might have this radical and apocalyptic vision of the threats that are posed to the United States, but I think one of the greatest threats that's posed to the United States is the erosion of constitutional democracy. And that is, you pave the way to the erosion of constitutional democracy by engaging in relentless attacks on the media. So I'm not sure what kind of country Bannon is trying to protect if the cost of his radical gestures of protection is the erosion of the very things that make the country worth protecting in the first place.
Well, the blizzard of tweets coming from President Trump in response to what's just happened with the resignation or the firing of the National Security Advisor, General Flynn, basically about these illegal leaks, and that's what the real story is, and information is being illegally given to the failing New York Times and Washington Post by the intelligence community, NSA and FBI, just like Russia. The real scandal here is that classified information is illegally given out by intelligence like candy, very un-American. Now, those comments are being echoed throughout the right-wing media by Fox News and the Daily Caller. And by the way, these are the news organs now that in the White House press room, and they tend to be favored in the very brief photo ops. They're the ones that get asked. So it's very difficult now to ask the president any real questions about what's happening because they throw these crazy softball questions out at him. But I guess the broader question here would be, Lawrence Douglas, and that is there a method to the Trump White House's mendacity? In other words, are they talking to those people in the Fox bubble, and what their lies ring true to people inside the Fox bubble?
Yes, no, I'm sure there's absolutely a very thought out method to their mendacity. I mean, basically, you have a large percentage of the electorate that relies on these alternative news organizations as their source of news, and which actually have absolutely no confidence, as far as we can tell, in the veracity of what we might say are our standard news organizations. And that's a very frightening proposition. Because if their only sources of information are misinformation, then basically what you have is you have an administration which has denied its base of supporters access to facts with which they could engage in a truthful assessment of the performance of the people in power. And that's a very discouraging and dangerous state of affairs.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Dukmanyuk, and The Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, Lying Got Michael Flynn Fired, But That's What the Trump White House Does Best. Well, apparently Trump gets information from Alex Jones of InfoWars, who's absolutely rabid and way out there on the fringes of reality. But he's somehow in that kind of weird terrain between the far left and the far right where they meet. I mean, he's the propagator of the 9/11 truther conspiracy and the producer of their sort of the primer for their movement, a film called Loose Change. And that's what I wonder about in this country. You know, there have been obviously academic studies and books like The Paranoid Nature of American Politics. What do you think is the cause or the roots of this alienation that American citizens on the far right and on the far left, in fact, not so far in both cases anymore, it's sort of creeping towards the center, it's a growing constituency. What causes this alienation that people really don't feel that this is their government?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to really speculate what it is about, contemporary American reality such that, people are such that they're willing to engage in such fantastical conspiracy theory thinking. But the one thing that I find truly shocking is the idea that this has now become mainstreamed by, you know, the presence of the United States and by his chief political strategist. That strikes me as the truly bizarre phenomenon. I mean, we can go back, as you mentioned, we can go back to, Richard Hofstadter writing decades ago about the paranoid style in American politics and about anti-intellectualism in American politics. But we've never seen it being mainstreamed in the way we're seeing it right now. And as you've also suggested, I think there are, you know, very cynical and tactical political reasons for why people like Bannon and why this particular White House is mainstreaming this, because it really is a way of creating not alternate facts, but really almost kind of an alternate reality that is insulated from contact with the real world. And once you insulate people from, that is your base of supporters, from evaluating your performance, then basically you can do whatever you want.
So what is the learning curve here, or is there a learning curve? Because one of the first things that Donald Trump did, I think it was in fact his first executive order, was to make it more expensive for working families to get mortgages, which is a pretty basic ladder up into the middle class. And he was absolutely flagrantly attacking the very constituency who he promised to help and to drain the swamp.
Exactly. So I guess, you know, my only hope is, and maybe this is a desperate hope, but I'm not sure where else we should hope. The hope is that to the extent that standard news organizations continue to do their jobs, continue to engage in rigorous fact-checking, that at some point people will turn away from the sources of information that are telling them X, when the rest of their lives is telling them why. And at some point, you know, people hold up a mirror to what they're reading and to the lived reality of their lives and say, something is wrong here, and maybe I need to be getting information from other sources.
Well, perhaps humor is a way to do it. I mean, I think that Melissa McCarthy's depiction of Sean Spicer is pretty powerful and right on the money. And I remember for example, the House of Un-American Activities terrorized a lot of people on the political left in the 1950s and all the way through into the 60s. And it ruined lives and careers, etc. But eventually it was the sort of yippie Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin who showed up before the House of Un-American Activities dressed as soldiers of the Revolutionary War and accused these congresspeople of being communists, you know, which is what the accusation that they were hurling at everybody else. So it took sort of the theater of the absurd to sort of burst the bubble. Maybe I'm grasping at straws, but it would seem so far in the political zeitgeist, if you will, I find people like Melissa McCarthy to be pretty effective.
Yes, I mean, I think, and maybe we're all grasping at straws at this stage, but I think that's true. I mean, I think humor can be a very potent form of resistance, and it can be also a potent form of truth-telling. Also, people like John Oliver, very impressive, and actually rigorously researched as well. So there is kind of this way in which very important political points are being leavened with humor, which makes the whole thing perhaps far more digestible.
But in terms of the divide between, in this country, the red state, blue state, Democrat, Republican divide, it seems more polarized than ever. And I'm wondering, I just heard a report on the radio the other day about how these dating services are being set up by liberal groups and by conservative groups. And the litmus test is, if you're a Trump supporter, a woman's basically going to say, no way, I'm going to go out with you because you support a guy who feels he has the right to grab women by the you-know-what. So I'm wondering whether that's sort of exacerbating the divide. My sense is that at some point or other, there's got to be a way to educate the Trump supporters, not in a kind of self-righteous liberal preaching way, but in a more empathetic way, that they're being had. I mean, nobody wants to know that they bought a lemon, you know? it's hard to get that message across. So I'm not suggesting it's easy, but what are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you completely. I mean, there has to be ways to do this. I mean, we do have a, you know, we have an educational system in the United States. I mean, hopefully that, you know, that's meant to perform some kind of civic function. And, I mean, the fact of the matter is it's hard to imagine a working, much less thriving, constitutional democracy in the absence of any kind of civil and civic discourse. And the grounds of civic discourse are really kind of being eroded beneath our feet. And we have to find ways to have conversations, exactly as you say, we have to find ways to have conversations which are not patronizing, which are not rubbing people's noses in defeat or just accusing them of bad faith. I mean, of course, there's a very terrible, and this is the saddest thing, there's a terrible example that's coming from the White House itself. I mean, the White House is engaged in exactly the kind of speechifying which is radically inconsistent with the kind of conversations and discourse and discussions we need to have as citizens if we're to avoid, you know, really kind of a world of hurt.
But I think, as you point out in your article at The Guardian, Lawrence Douglas, lying got Michael Flynn fired, but that's what the Trump White House does best. You say that the problem began on day one, having brazenly refused to remove himself from his far-flung business interest. Trump has been in violation of the Constitution from the instant that he swore to uphold it. And of course, that's a reference to the Emoluments Clause, which, frankly, nobody even thought would ever come up. It's been dormant for hundreds of years, but
exactly.
Nevertheless, it's there. But you could surely take it back a little further, couldn't you? I thought that when he got away with not releasing his income taxes and that the press were unable or the Democrats or nobody was able to shame him into doing it, I thought that was an important moment. And, of course, that happened in the context of a campaign where the mainstream media, which is to some extent turning on him now, basically gave him $5 billion worth of free publicity.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you had to ask, you know, Donald Trump, you know, what incentive does he have for changing at this stage of the game? And the answer has to be very little incentive. I mean, he has gotten to where he is by tearing up the rule book. And everyone said that, well, doing what you're doing certainly can't lead to you winning the nomination. You prove them wrong. Certainly can't lead to you being elected president of the United States. Prove them wrong. Now, maybe it is the case that he will finally realize the limits of his way of doing politics now that he's president, and it simply will be unsustainable, this way in which he engages in this incredible cavalier ignoring of, you know, basic rules and basic norms of political discourse. But up until now, there's been very little reason for why he should change, because he has been rewarded for every step he's taken so far.
Well, of course, just in closing, though, the irony is that Flynn got fired because he lied to the vice president. And here you have a vice president who's an aggressively Christian fundamentalist who presumably believes in the Ten Commandments and thou shalt not bear false witnesses flying about all around him, and somehow he doesn't, that doesn't bother him, right?
Only yes, no, exactly.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that is really one of the ironies here is, you know, Flynn is being fired. He's fired not for engaging in this outrageous behind-the-back diplomacy. He's being fired for lying to the vice president, whereas, you know, lying and telling falsehoods has been really one of the signature acts of this young Trump presidency.
Well, Lawrence Douglas, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Dukmanjic and the Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, Lying Got Michael Flynn Fired, But That's What the Trump White House Does Best. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the downfall of Trump's nominee for Secretary of Labor, Andy Puzder.
I learned a good way. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Judith Conte, who is the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the National Employment Law Project. She's also the co-founder and former executive director of the DC Employment Justice Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Judith Conte.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be here.
Well, thank you, Judith. And Donald Trump said he'd get all of his cabinet nominees through. It looks like one of them has failed to get through. He's withdrawn his nomination, Andy Puzder, for Secretary of Labor. It doesn't look as if he was disqualified because of his appalling record in terms of being hostile to labor and the interests of working Americans, but rather that he was a wife beater.
You know, I don't know that that's really the tipping point. I think there were a lot of problems with Andy Puzder. From the beginning, it was clear that he had an utter disdain for the low-wage workforce that has made him millions and that he was utterly unsuited to be the Secretary of Labor. It was also equally clear that he put people over profits at every turn. And that was, part of what delayed his paperwork for so long, that allowed one delay after another, four different delays of his confirmation hearing, and it allowed advocates to really dig, and it allowed them to get, and workers to get out there and to protest, and for the press to really investigate this man. And they found out that he couldn't even follow the most basic laws for the people he employed in his own home. And they found out that his record of wage and hour and workplace safety violations was in the 50% rate. They found out that, again, that he had a disdain for his workforce, that he had much higher than average claims of discrimination at his places of employment. And I think that's really what sunk this guy. It was a total picture of somebody who, a successful entrepreneur, but was completely unsuited to be the nation's chief advocate for working people.
So this 27-year-old episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show featuring Andy Puzder's former wife, Lisa Firestein. Mm-hmm. This was aired in 1919, and mm-hmm. the title of the episode was called High Class Battered Women. And she appeared in some with a wig and sunglasses and talked about being beaten by her husband, mm-hmm. and who said, I will see you in the gutter. This will never be over. You will pay for mm-hmm. this, etc. Now, that tape was sent to, the Oprah Winfrey mm-hmm. people sent it to all the members of the Senate panel at HELP, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And are there women on that committee? I mean, it would seem to me that the assumption is that did have an effect.
Well, you know, there are a number of women on both sides of the aisle on the Health, Education, Labor, Pensions Committee. But the fact is that there was ample evidence that Andy Puzder did not really have a tremendous respect for the woman worker in this country. A number of years ago when he took over CKE restaurants, he put together an ad campaign that was, you know, taking, you know, women in scanty bikinis, very in very sexualized ways, eating hamburgers and condiments dripping off their hands. I mean, it was softcore porn that actually carries a parental advisory on YouTube these days. And I think that speaks volume to his attitude about women, women workers, and the way that he values them in the workforce. And it's no wonder that close to two-thirds of the women who the Restaurant Opportunity Center surveyed from CKE Industries report incidents of sexual harassment in the workforce, whether it be from coworkers, managers, or the customers who come in attracted by these ads and wonder why they don't see women that look like that. And I think that's the real problem that we have with Andy Puzder, is that the acts he performed as an employer, as an entrepreneur, as a CEO, show very well what he thinks of his women in the workforce, that they are sexualized commodities that he can use for his own personal financial gain.
So do you think that was a plus or a minus with his boss, Donald Trump, who ran the Miss Universe contest?
I don't think Donald Trump minded the ads at all. I will leave it at that.
Okay. And these, you're referring to the Carl's Jr. ads, right?
Correct.
So what's then the situation now vis-a-vis a substitute? I mean, you've got to be careful what you wish for. You know, it's possible that Michael Flynn could be replaced by John Bolton, for example.
Well, it's very true. I mean, look, careful what you wish for, and no good deed goes unpunished. So we have to wait and see who comes next. But I think the remarkable thing about Puzder's withdrawal is that it came because grassroots advocates and workers across the country took to the streets and said, not this guy. Donald Trump is a man who ran as a champion of working people. He pledged to put the American worker first in his inauguration speech, and instead he nominates a man who consistently puts profits over people. And people saw the sham when he nominated Andy Puzder and said, no way. So I think there's a very strong message to the administration that people are going to hold out for somebody who actually is a champion for working people. And hopefully they will heed that advice, and the next Secretary of Labor nominee will be somebody who is a true public servant and has the interests of workers at mind.
And again, I'm speaking with Judith Conte, who is the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the National Employment Law Project. She's also the co-founder and former executive director of the DC Employment Justice Center. So what is then the attitude? I mean, one of the things that seems to be happening now is as the White House becomes more paralyzed and dysfunctional, the Republican leadership in Congress seem to be absolutely, perhaps it's even distracting the public from what they're doing, and they are working very aggressively. As you know, almost all of the cabinet appointees are in the category of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. These are people who are hostile to the very mission of the government agency that they're put in charge of, with, say, Betsy DeVos at Education being an example, and Puzder, of course, was a flagrant example. Mm-hmm. So is this... in terms of what's happening on the Hill, my sense is that McConnell, Ryan, Pence, and everybody are very happy that Trump delivered them the power to change America and enact the Koch brothers' agenda, which they're doing aggressively. And meanwhile, the press is covering the latest follies from the White House.
You know, I think all of us, press and informed constituents alike, need to keep our eyes on the ball, certainly. I think that it is great that people across the country paid attention to Betsy DeVos and to Andy Puzder, because education and our jobs are two fundamental aspects of, you know, virtually everybody's life. You need a good education. You or the breadwinner in your family needs a good job to support your family. And people are really responding in these moments. So though Betsy DeVos was confirmed just barely, she is somebody who's gone in under a real cloud of suspicion about her basic qualifications for the job. And Andy Puzder was forced to withdraw on a bipartisan basis. So people are paying attention. I am quite certain that all members of Congress are paying attention to this as well. We can only hope that the White House is too.
But you work on Capitol Hill, so mm-hmm. give us an insight into whether that basic premise of mine is operating, because I'm not entirely sure how much the Republican leadership need Trump. He's delivered them the power that they wanted, and they're very aggressively enacting what I describe as the Koch brothers' agenda. It's, I think this is arguably the most furthest to the right government we've had in the United States in recent memory, if not in history. So,
well, it's important to recognize that the Republican Congress hasn't really enacted much of anything yet. They're certainly trying. They have tried already to, for the 67th time, is it perhaps, to remove the ACA, and they're finding it a lot harder to do than they thought it would be. So I think the jury is still out. I think that progressives in general, but also just average people who understand the importance of good government and an important safety net and social insurance net, are absolutely fighting back, and I think it's going to be a lot more difficult for Congress to do what they wanted to do than they thought it was going to be.
Well, of course, I don't want them to go after the ACA, but I want them to go after Obamacare. Mm-hmm. I'm being facetious.
We will see what happens. I think it's funny. Like, you know, you've heard so many media reports about people who hate Obamacare but love the Affordable Care Act. They don't really know that the two are anything different.
Right.
So, careful, as I said earlier about ourselves, careful what you wish for. We have to see who the next nominee is going to be. Careful what you wish for. When you've got control of all three branches of government, it's not so easy. And I think the Republicans are already finding it much harder to govern than they thought they would.
Well, there's one rule change, though, isn't there, that I think the Senate enacted where people, I think on Social Security, who had histories of mental disability, were forbidden from purchasing firearms. I think it was about 115,000 people involved. That has been removed, right? So, in other words, people with mental problems now can buy firearms.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I'd say it's not the issue that I follow most closely, since I specialize in labor and employment policy. Mm. But yes, as I understand it, is now easier for people with emotional difficulties and diagnosed mental illness to buy guns, and that is a tragedy and a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to see people all over the country rising up to fight against it.
So, did the fight, because I covered the fight for 15 people, and I talked to a lot of people on the picket lines, et cetera, and that was a very effective movement. How does that tie into the groundswell against PASDA?
The fight for 15 was perhaps one of the most indispensable partners in this entire effort. And the way that the workers who make up that movement were willing to put themselves on the line. I mean, it's not easy to go out and protest against your boss and to strike on a day when you're supposed to be working. It carries tremendous risk. And I think the fact that people are so willing to put themselves and their livelihood on the line speaks volumes to members of Congress, and they understand this isn't, you know, PUSDR's folks tried to manufacture outrage that this was all big labor and a smear campaign and fake news. It just wasn't. It simply just wasn't. It was real people who'd said enough is enough. This is not who represents me. And I think that the contributions of the fight for 15 are inestimable.
Well, just in closing, the Huffington Post is reporting on PASDA's macho public image forged from his statements about his unabashed love of boobs and burgers, which we were talking about a minute ago. Apparently, he sold his $8 million mansion in California to a porn mogul. So there you have it.
I think that just speaks for itself, and we'll leave it there.
I didn't mean to lower the tone of the conversation, Judith. I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Judith Conte, who is the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the National Employment Law Project. She's also the co-founder and former Executive Director of the D.C. Employment Justice Center. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.